Found this story in USA Today. In a changing city, voices raised over a call to prayer. It's a story out of the Detroit area. Now, if you know anything about Detroit, you perhaps know that it is one of the U.S. cities with the highest population of Muslims in it. Immigrants from various Muslim countries, Iran, Iraq, and many others as well. What's the story? The story is perhaps they're going to change a city ordinance, a noise ordinance, to allow the five-time-a-day call to prayer over a loudspeaker from the mosques of this little town outside of Detroit. We're going to be talking about that story here for the first half of this second hour of Issues, Etc. Farouk Khan will be our guest, Director of North American Ministries for Pablo, that's People of the Book Lutheran Outreach, based in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. We'll find out what he has to say about this story. A little later in the hour, Tamara Lipper will be our guest, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Some reaction to George W. Bush's primetime press conference last week. If you read the story of which Tamara is co-author, the story called The Gospel According to George, and if you've been hearing anything about Bob Woodward's book called Plan of Attack, you'll know what we're talking about here. The president, and I want to do a little bit of this during Open Lines as well that follows that conversation with Tamara. The president gave a very rare primetime press conference. He's done a number of press conferences, about a dozen all said, but only three now were prime time. And there was a lot of reaction to what he had to say, to his tone, to his basic message, but also to the White House press corps and the questions that they were putting to the president. Probably no tougher than any other presidents have seen in a time like this, in a time of crisis. We'll be talking about that during Open Lines and a little bit before that with Tamara Lipper of Newsweek magazine. And then Open Lines for your questions and your comments. I do, if I have time, want to get to the latest Ten Commandments, if you will, from Rick Warren, published by Baptist Press in their first-person column. No more suggestions from Rick Warren. Now he's telling us what we must do to grow our churches. Then in the last half hour of Issues, Etc., we'll be talking with Janice Krauss, director and senior fellow for the Beverly LaHaye Institute of Concerned Women for America, about the march that's coming up in Washington, D.C. this Sunday, the March for Freedom of Choice, involving virtually every pro-choice organization and a few other organizations this coming Sunday. Farouk Khan has been a regular guest on Issues, Etc. He's director of North American Ministries for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach, based in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Farouk, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Your reaction to the story about the possibility of changing a noise ordinance there near Detroit to allow the call for prayer among Muslims?
Well, I was watching the TV this morning when I watched the lady who had been advocating her part of the story that there would be a lot of noise in the area on this very issue, and there were some Muslim representatives on the television on Fox 2 News, and they were saying that a call of prayer for Muslims is just like the church bells that you have. And so they were doing their advocacy, and this is where both the parties were this morning when I heard on the TV. But I have born and grown among Muslims, and I have come from a Muslim country. I lived for 17 years in Saudi Arabia, which is in the heart of Islam, and now I come to the United States. The thing, my own reaction is that church bells do not ring up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're not that loud, and I do have sympathy for those who live very close to the mosque that they're talking about, and if there is a call of prayer early morning, 4 o'clock, especially for those people who do not know what they're saying.
Tell us about this call for prayer and what its origins in the Muslim practice are. I'm aware of the fact that Muslims are required to pray on a regular basis every day. What about the call to prayer?
Call to prayer is that they say it very loud that it's time for prayer, but there is certain rhythm and certain tune these people say loud, they start with Allahu Akbar, God is great, and then the main thing is this, it started in the early Muslim era when one of the slaves who became Muslim, Bilal, he said the first call to prayer. And this is how it became a practice. And in Muslim countries, it's a very, very much into practice because they put big loudspeakers and you can hear the sound for miles and miles. And sometimes there are five mosques in the area and every one of them is calling. And this might happen in Hamtramck too, because I think there are more than one mosque. And the only reason what I'm saying is that the actual original call of prayers were said without the microphone, without the loudspeakers. So especially when they are saying in Arabic, those people who live around, neither they will understand. The only thing is this, that the noise level will grow. My own comments on the issue is that we as Christians, we love our Muslim brothers. And I as a Christian person, heading an outreach, say that they are also, Christ died on the cross for them also. So I do have love for them. But on the other hand, what I want to say is that we should be fair to all the people. When we cannot teach Bible in the school, when our nativity scenes intimidate people in the schools, when we are, as Christians, are not allowed to worship in many parts of the world, then if there is every kind of freedom, then call of prayer is not something that would hold them from worshiping their God in their way.
So in other words, the Muslim household there near Detroit, the average Muslim household, they will be engaging in their hours of prayer, whether or not a public address system out in the streets from the mosque is loudly calling them to prayer during those hours.
Almost every Muslim house has got an alarm clock which starts giving the call of prayer when the prayer time is. They keep these clocks in the house, and these clocks starts just like an alarm starts ringing on a clock. It starts giving the same call of prayer on the clock. So there is no, and there is a specific time for their call of prayer. So everyone knows what is the time, and they can go to the mosque for a prayer. But what if an old man or a man with a heart case lives very next to the mosque, and there's a loud call of prayer early in the morning at 4 o'clock, what do you think he will feel?
I'd like your reaction to comments made in the Associated Press story that covered this by Masood Khan. He's secretary of the Al-Isla Mosque there in the area. He says the purpose of the call, which lasts less than 2 minutes, is not to proselytize. Quote, "We are not inviting non-Muslims," he said. "We are calling our Muslim people, reminding them that they are obligated to come and pray."
But on the other hand, it is so loud and so strong that those Christians or any other religions, Jews or Hindus or Sikhs who are living in the neighborhood, they will be waking them up also early in the morning. So what about the comfort of your neighbor? We are coveting his rights too.
Tell us about your life as a Muslim. You said you grew up with this. And how do you regard, he says it's not an effort to proselytize. Do you consider that genuine?
He is right in saying that, because you would not be able to preach your religion through an Arabic language which nobody understands around, except the people who are from that very religious group and that very religious belief. This is 100% true. But on the other hand, I'm only talking on the noise level and the disturbance of the neighbor. That why would you try to disturb your neighbor?
So if the situation were that, for instance, church bells or Christian hymns or something like that were being broadcast in a neighborhood over a loud speaker system, as some churches do on a Sunday morning, sounds of carillons or bells, would that change, and say a Jewish, perhaps a Jewish hymn or a Jewish voice from a synagogue. If all these things were ringing out loudly in the neighborhood, would you have a problem at all with the mosque having the same rights there in the public?
I would say when everybody is doing it, then everybody has the right to do it also. But the thing is this, you see, it's like one-way traffic. This month's Voice of the Martyrs has a picture on the front page. This pastor, who happens to be from the same city where I come from in Pakistan, he was murdered because he was in his church singing the hymns at the time when the call of prayer was going. And he received 3 bullets, right? The gun was put on his heart and fired at. So he has 7 children left behind. So there should be no one-way traffic, you know, when you cannot tolerate Christians to have a nativity scene in the church or have a prayer in the school or nativity scene in the school. Then you should be accommodating enough to take care of their comfort and something that might not intimidate them too.
You mentioned earlier that you grew up, at least until the age of 17, in Saudi Arabia.
No, I lived for 17 years in Saudi Arabia, and I worked as a material engineer in Saudi Arabia.
When you were there, would a public address system from a Christian church giving any kind of a call to Christian prayer been permitted in that country?
In Saudi Arabia, to carry your personal Bible is a crime. To worship is a bigger crime. To carry more than one Bible is even bigger than that. And to have several Bibles, you will end up in jail for 10 years. And you cannot worship, you cannot teach, you cannot preach, you cannot openly say that you are a Christian, you cannot wear a cross around your neck. So that is what I am saying, is that in our whatever is left of the Christian faith, in the places where the Christian countries are or Christians live, we should have at least some kind of accommodation for Christians, for the foreigners who come and call U.S. their home, that they should not also hurt the feelings of the people who have lived here for generations.
Farouk Khan is our guest. He's director of North American Ministries for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach, based in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. We're talking about the controversy in the Detroit area of Michigan surrounding whether or not mosques should be able to issue the traditional Islamic call to prayer over loudspeakers several times a day. Farouk, how big is the Muslim population in Greater Detroit?
Well, the Zogby survey says they are between 300 to 325,000. Muslim areas claim that they are between 400 to 450,000. But they are spread all over. The biggest cluster of Muslims is living in Dearborn East, and there is a fair amount of Bangladeshi background population living in Hamtramck.
How do you respond to kind of what's been generally observed about adherence to Islam, that when they live in the United States, for instance, Detroit is a great example, even when they live in large numbers there, they generally tend to be have a very peace-loving persona. The mosques don't call for fatwas. None of these kind of things take place. And the persona, the public persona of Islam, is very peace-loving. And yet the same religion, perhaps even the same adherence, if in a Muslim state, it seems the persona of the religion is completely different.
You are absolutely right. It is different. The Islam, I would say Ikhwan al-Muslimin in Egypt and Jamaat Islami, and there are several other Harkat al-Ansar and other groups in Pakistan, and then we have got the Algerian group, and we have got the Chechen group, and we have got the other parts of the world like Islam, Wahhabi Islam. And when we look at all this, the Iranian Islam, they have a different face in every country. In America, they talk about love and brotherhood and kindness and forgiveness, and we don't find that in Saudi Arabia. You talk about Christianity, you end up in jail. I'll give you 2 quick examples. On one Christmas season, there's some storekeeper. I went to the shopping mall in Al Khobar, Saudi Arabia, and they were crushing chocolates under the feet, the Saudi religious police, because the wrapping on the chocolate was red, green, and white. And they said this is Christmas color, and why were they imported? because they were right at the Christmas season. So these kind of things cannot be even tolerated in the heart of Islam. There is no church in whole of Saudi Arabia. So what I'm saying is that when you do not allow even somebody to practice his own religion, carry his own Bible into a country, then you build, same country sends money and builds up mosques in America. And on the other hand, now a call of prayer and what else tomorrow?
Which one is the real Islam? The one that you experienced in Saudi Arabia with no religious tolerance, no, as you say, no word of forgiveness and brotherhood, or the Islam we see there in the mosques in the Detroit area where it is all about brotherhood and forgiveness?
I would say the best form of Muslims you find are those Muslims who are living as a minority in some other country. Because they practice, they abide by the laws, and they live in certain norms. But in other countries, like in Pakistan, there is a blasphemy law, which is in Pakistan, and to have their personal counts, people are being booked and jailed just on trumped-up cases of blasphemy.
But are those Muslims who live in Western countries as minorities, are they compromising the genuine teachings of Islam? Or are the people in the Islamic nations, where they have a majority, are they taking it too far?
I would say the Muslim countries, most of them, they rule their countries by the power of the religion. They use religion as a stick, and that is why they deal everybody very strictly. And most of the countries, you see, I will tell you, the street power in every Muslim country is in the hands of the mosque. And the mosques use their microphones, megaphones, loudspeakers to convey the message to the people. And that happens in Pakistan, and that happens in many other Muslim countries. So I would say that the street power is in the hands of these mosques, and they use them for their own benefit.
Farouk, if Muslims, you said first it's a desire for a public call to prayer, and then tomorrow what? If Muslims became a majority in this country, what would it look like then?
It would look like a country where the government is toppled every day, and there will be, I think, hatred in every street. I see in many Islamic countries, Shiites and Muslims killing each other. Shiites and Sunnis killing each other, throwing mosques in the bombs in the mosques. And I would say that if America becomes a Muslim majority country, then I would say the work of Christian church throughout the world will come to an end.
What is the greatest challenge, apart from what you mentioned before, say in Saudi Arabia, absolutely no religious freedom for non-Muslims? Apart from that, what is the greatest challenge facing someone who would try and carry in their Bible the faith it contains and the message of the cross to Muslims?
The biggest challenge that a Christian faces is, you see, there are two things. The first thing is this, you have to carry the message of love, message of salvation, message of forgiveness. But the biggest challenge that a Christian who is carrying his gospel message and going to a Muslim is a trust, to build up a trust with a Muslim. And that is one of the most difficult things.
Why is that so difficult to do?
Because the Muslims don't trust you. They say if you come to them and you want to be friendly with them, there is some hidden motive behind it.
And how would you, a former Muslim, how are you viewed by practicing Muslims?
Well, I would say that I am 100% not a former Muslim. My one generation up, they converted from Islam. But I would say the law of apostasy of Islam, which is written by one of the most learned scholars of Islam, Maulana Mauduri, he says that the punishment for an apostate is death. And in Hadith Bukhari, which is the traditions of Bukhari, it clearly says that anyone who disowns Islam, kill him. So it is the people in Pakistan or any other country in the world, if they are living in a Muslim country and somebody comes to know that this person is a Christian believer or has become Christian, before he even reaches the court, he will be dead man.
What are your hopes? You live there in a city up in Michigan where, as you say, by conservative estimates, you've got 300, perhaps 400,000 Muslims and more every day. What is your deepest hope as someone who is trying to build a bridge so that the gospel can be heard there among those Muslims?
My biggest hope is this, that the whole world may know that Jesus died on that cross for them also. And when we look at the Passion of Christ, that the cinema halls were full in Qatar and in Kuwait, and people were picking up pirated cassettes and DVDs in Saudi Arabia, when we get these kind of reports that the message of Jesus travels to them, that whatever pain and suffering Jesus took was in passion and in love for the people, all the people, as we see in 1 John 2:2, it's written, his atoning sacrifice was not for us alone, but for the whole world. So what I have this thing is that I wish and pray that people may find Jesus in their life. There will be love, forgiveness, kindness, and there will be no hatred. There will be no wars. There will be no terrorism. There will be no killing.
Farooq Khan, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Welcome.
Farooq Khan is director of North American Ministries for Pablo, People of the Book Lutheran Outreach, based in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Their website, by the way, is pablo.org, P-A-B-L-O.org. You can also reach them via telephone at area code 313-563-2051, 313-563-2051. When we come back from this break, Tamara Lipper is going to be our guest, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and co-author of a story in the latest issue of Newsweek titled The Gospel According to George. It's general reaction to two things. One, last week's third primetime news conference given by President George W. Bush, the general reaction there, and all of that in light of the latest book by Bob Woodward, Plan of Attack. You've heard about the book. You saw the press conference. When we're done with our conversation with Tamara, I'd like your reaction as well. We'll have open lines then, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd also like your reaction to this Michigan issue. This is something that it's hard to believe that we've got a Midwest city where there is this is 300,000 to 400,000 Muslims living in one area there near Detroit. If this were happening here, and this is an issue of a noise ordinance, should we allow the call to prayer 5 times a day, beginning before sunrise and ending after sunset, for the Muslims who live here? How would you react to it if it were happening here in St. Louis? What do you think about it happening up there in Michigan? We'll take that up during open lines as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then, in the last 30 minutes of the program, Janice Krause will join us from Concerned Women for America to talk about this Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice being put on by virtually every pro-choice organization in the United States. They're in Washington, D.C. They're hoping for big numbers, but something you'll hear in that interview, they're having to expand the subject matter in order to get more people to come. That's in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many today equate the worship of God with feeling good about God or about themselves. What is the genuine worship of God through which God heals our anxiety, our depression, and our guilt? Where can we find worship that's focused on God's forgiveness rather than our feelings? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. It's by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Richard Iyer. You can order They Will See His Face by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called They Will See His Face. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A pro-abortion rally is planned for this weekend in Washington, D.C. One of the groups sponsoring the demonstration is the National Education Association. Troubling news for all those pro-life teachers around the country. But there's not much they can do about it. Keith Peters reports.
Connie Bancroft is a middle school teacher of handicapped children. She's also executive director of Teachers Saving Children National, an Ohio-based group of over 3,300 pro-life educators. She says the NEA claims it's neutral on the issue of abortion, yet they are sponsoring this weekend's March for Freedom of Choice in Washington.
They did nothing with the March for Life in January, but yet they support something like this. They're very clearly one-sided when they do support and sponsor things.
Mike Schwartz of Concerned Women for America says the NEA's decision to sponsor the march is deeply offensive.
To the best of my knowledge, the NEA is the only union in the whole country that is investing in this parade and that's coming out publicly in support of it. And that is a terrible violation of the trust of their members.
And Schwartz says there is nothing that anybody can do about it.
Teachers in our country are being forced, whether they like it or not, to support this abortion march, regardless of their personal convictions, regardless of their very appropriate professional judgment that teachers should not be involved in public policy issues like that.
Connie Bancroft urges educators to support Teachers Saving Children National as an alternative to the liberal NEA. The National Education Association did not return a phone call seeking comment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
The March for Freedom of Choice, as it's called, is also sponsored by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the National Organization for Women. Many are worried that the demonstration will get violent because of anarchist groups that are planning to take part. Meanwhile, pro-life organizations are planning silent opposition along the parade route. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here's an AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Tuesday, April 20th, 2004, Wilbert and Dorothy Thielemann. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in honor of their wedding anniversary, which they are celebrating today. Once again, we say thank you to Wilbert and Dorothy Thielemann of Nashville, Illinois, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsors. And best wishes for a very happy anniversary. How does worship heal anxiety, guilt, loneliness, and grief? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April deals with worship and healing. It's titled, They Will See His Face. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. The title of the book, They Will See His Face.
Free Iraq will show that America is on the side of Muslims who wish to live in peace. We've already shown in Kuwait and Kosovo, Bosnia and Afghanistan.
That's President George W. Bush in his prime time press conference last week, the third in his term so far. President George W. Bush was talking at length about, well, sending a message, if you will, about his determination. And the press conference was very carefully watched by people on both sides of the issue of the war in Iraq, the war on terrorism, and all of the other issues as well. Now, during Open Lines, I'd like to get your reaction to the president's press conference last week. We really haven't had opportunity to do that here on Issues Etc. yet. But first, earlier today, I had opportunity to talk with Tamara Lipper. She's White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and co-author of a story in the latest issue of Newsweek titled The Gospel According to George, reacting to the president's press conference last week. I began by asking Tamara, why the title The Gospel According to George?
I think with the title, what we were trying to convey was a central point that was illustrated in the president's appearance last week in prime time, which is that this is a president who really leads by conviction, that his belief, his faith, in fact, in the efforts in Iraq and in the greater effort to bring democracy to the Middle East almost takes on the level of a gospel. It is something that he holds with such conviction that despite any difficulties on the ground, despite whatever mistakes may or may not have been made in the conflict in Iraq, he has no doubts about the overall mission and the goal and beliefs behind which he's pursuing this policy in the Middle East.
Give us, if you could, a few quick examples from the primetime press conference of what you're talking about there.
Well, the president was asked over and over again by various journalists variants of the same question, which was seeking for him to admit mistakes either in the prosecuting the war on terrorism or more specifically in Iraq. For instance, on do we have enough U.S. troops in Iraq? Shouldn't we have had more from the get-go, for instance? And the president was really careful to try to strike the right balance, that his message to the American people was to show resolve, to show the importance of what we were doing there in the Middle East, to show that he wasn't going to back down despite the difficulties that he was readily acknowledging. Yet he would not sort of go into the specifics of mistakes being made, either on the troop question or anything else, because in his view, those were all efforts to basically get him to admit that going into Iraq itself was a big mistake, and that's something that he and his aides were very careful, very intent on never, ever letting any suggestion that that would be the case.
Two things on that. To what degree do you think the president was being cautious about sending the wrong message to our opponents in Iraq and also to our opponents in organized terrorism?
Well, I think that there were three audiences, if you will. One was the American people, of course, who had been seeing all the difficulties in Iraq on their TV screens for weeks now, and he wanted to shore up his own support, particularly in this election year, for the efforts in Iraq and make clear that he understood that it was difficult and he appreciated and was not detached or disconnected from the realities of the situation. That was one audience. Another audience was the Iraqi people. That one thing this administration has always said from the get-go was that, and this is why the president has been so insistent on sticking to the June 30th date for transferring sovereignty, for example, is to say to the Iraqi people that our word is good, that we said we're going to give you sovereignty on June 30th, and we mean that despite anything that may be happening on the ground. And then thirdly is that audience that you were specifically asking about, which are what they call enemies of freedom and democracy in Iraq, and the intent that if you do show any sort of weakness or question the policy or question how we've pursued this war, that it emboldens those who want to see us fail in the Middle East and specifically in Iraq. And the president certainly is aware of that potential, and he wants to make clear that he's not going to fall into that trap. And part of you've seen just this week, the president had some regretful words in a phone call with the new prime minister of Spain, for example, who's announced that he's pulling troops out of Iraq. He sees that as sending a bad message to those who are enemies of our goals in Iraq, and that it does strengthen their hand and signal that they are succeeding when they attack coalition and Iraqi people. And so that is true. That is definitely one of the messages that was very intent on the president's mind that he wanted to send, that you cannot win, you cannot beat us by driving us out of Iraq, that we will not get scared, we will not be intimidated, and we will not run.
Secondly, he is also running for re-election. He's less than 7 months out from election day, and I wonder whether or not presidents generally want to admit mistakes in the last year of their first term.
They're really not. Presidents really don't make mistakes, admit to making mistakes, rather, particularly on issues such centerpieces of policy as the war on terrorism and the war in Iraq. But the president, by appearing before the press last week, he was trying to walk a very fine line by acknowledging some of the unforeseen, perhaps, or maybe others, critics would say, the predictable difficulties and some of the outcomes that haven't been so good in Iraq, acknowledge that he understands that and he appreciates the sacrifice of troops and their families, for instance, but also show, you know, that he's sticking to his guns, that the policy he still believes is right. So it is a balance, and the White House wanted the American people to see that he could take tough questions head on, that he wasn't shirking his responsibility, that he wasn't trying to hide out in the White House, but that he was willing to defend his policies because he believed that they were right, and he was able to do so, you know, under some pretty tough questioning in front of the whole American primetime television audience.
How would you gauge the public reaction to the primetime press conference in general?
Well, I think the press reports gave him sort of fair to less than fair marks, particularly finding that he did not necessarily provide the specific details that would really bolster his broader statements. The president is very good with broad themes and expresses a lot of conviction. He sometimes doesn't necessarily go into great depth in backing up those convictions. But I think that, I think for the greater American people, he probably would get much better marks, because I think what came across was exactly what the White House intended. He came across as tough, as strong, as understanding of both what's going on in Iraq, but being able to lay forth a bit more than he has perhaps in the past of a plan to move from where we are now to eventually January 2005, when there will be free elections in Iraq. So I think that was important for the American people, who really, I believe, wanted to just be have a sense of being bucked up, to be reassured about the mission, and that there that although it's tough, that he does have a plan and he is in control of events in Iraq, and not just being kind of swept up in the random acts of violence that are occurring on the ground there.
We're talking about the reaction to President Bush's primetime press conference last week with Tamara Lipper, White House correspondent for Newsweek. Tamara, the talk radio take on the press conference focused more on the questions being asked by the press corps, and generally saying it was a gotcha press conference. Your reaction to that?
I think there is some truth to that kind of analysis, in that the press does take their job very seriously, what they believe their job to be, which is to really speak for the American people, ask the questions of the president, test him, test his policies. And with both the war in Iraq and some of the questions about the Bush administration's policy towards al-Qaeda before 9/11 that have been raised by some of the hearings that we've seen on Capitol Hill, I think there were some lingering doubts or questions about the policies being pursued. So to some degree, the press were, as I mentioned, very intent on really pressing the president, particularly on this issue of mistakes. And it's something that the White House anticipated. The president was warned by his advisors prior to the press conference in their preparation sessions that they expected the press to sort of work together a little more, to coordinate, to really try to follow up one another's questions, to really not let the president get off the hook on some of the tough subject matters. And I think that there is this sense, perhaps, that the president hasn't necessarily provided the most complete answers to those questions about, for instance, were we prepared to provide enough troops in Iraq? Was there, who are we handing the government over to on June 30th? All those kind of questions, which have been lingering for months and months and months.
One line intrigued me in the story in Newsweek, Tamara, and that was, it reads like this: if Karl Rove is the guru, the strategy is pure Martin Luther. Quote, "Here I stand, Bush seems to declare, I can do no other." What are you trying to say there?
That if, you know, people, Karl Rove is often believed to be sort of the kind of brains behind, or the grand strategist behind, the president's political operation. But truthfully, the president, what we saw last week is he is presenting himself as what he is, a man of conviction, a man of faith, plain spoken, honest in his efforts, and he's really trying to say, you know, take me at my word, take me at my belief and my conviction one way or the other. And he knows very well that this is going to be the determinant of whether he gets a second term or not. He was asked that question in the press conference about the election and how the outcome in Iraq might affect that. And he said, he acknowledged that, yes, it will be the voters' choice whether to give him another term, and if they don't like what he's done in Iraq and the war on terrorism, that they can kick him out of office. But he said also that he believes that he will get a second term precisely for his leadership on those issues. And this is not a man who is going to be able to sort of moderate or change or finesse his positions on these issues in order to make it perhaps do better in front of the electorate in November. He's essentially saying, here I am, take it or leave it, and is hoping and is fairly confident that at the end of the day, voters will take it.
Finally, Tamara, the book of the week, of course, is Bob Woodward's Plan of Attack. What's been the reaction from the White House, as far as you can tell, to that book?
Well, the White House can't really disavow the book or try to discredit Bob Woodward. First of all, he's regarded as too much of a top-notch journalist for that. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, is everybody in the White House and the administration, including the president, including Colin Powell, including Donald Rumsfeld, have all talked to Bob Woodward for the book. So as one White House aide said to me last week, we can't complain about quotes. We can't say that he misquoted the president, for instance, on any of these topics. So they've really had to embrace the book. And although they might dispute on a tiny point or not, such as we've seen Colin Powell this week try to say that, in fact, his relationship with Vice President Dick Cheney is fine and that they do talk, which is something Bob Woodward had reported in his book, that at times their differences in opinion on Iraq got so heightened that they were on not speaking terms. So they might sort of quibble with an anecdote here or there, but overall they are still claiming that the book is a fair and accurate contemporaneous history of the run up to the war in Iraq. And I think that in some regard they think that the Woodward book presents the president in a positive light, in that he is someone who is convinced of the need to remove Saddam Hussein from power. He did so with conviction, and that's essentially where he is now. He's not apologizing for it, and they believe that that's a position of strength to be in, particularly when we've seen polls this week indicating that he's holding strong and almost double-digit lead on the question of national security and terrorism over John Kerry. So they're feeling pretty okay with the Woodward book, despite the fact that it's the topic of much discussion and debate throughout Washington and I'm sure elsewhere in the country as well.
Folks, you can read Tamara's story in Newsweek, The Gospel According to George, at the website for Newsweek, newsweek.com. Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek and co-author of that story. Tamara, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
My pleasure, Todd. Thanks.
That's Tamara Lipp, a White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. The story, again, is called The Gospel According to George. Did you read this thing? What's your reaction to last week's third primetime news conference by President George W. Bush? I was intrigued by the quote there, and I mentioned it in that interview, the quote that's in the middle of the Newsweek story where it's talking about Karl Rove being the guru, Karl Rove being the advisor there. If Karl Rove is the guru, the strategy is pure Martin Luther. Here I stand, Bush seems to declare. I can do no other. Is that the message you got from the press conference last week in the White House? It's open lines for the next 90 minutes of the program, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I know that it's easy to think that just because someone has a microphone and radio program that makes them an expert on every matter, but I make no bones about this. I may be a political junkie. I am no expert whatsoever. I'd like your reaction, your honest reaction to the president's news conference. Here's a question for you. How did you react to it if you listened to it as opposed to saw it? There was an uncomfortable moment. Do you remember that uncomfortable moment for the president? Visibly, if you're watching it on television, an uncomfortable moment when he was asked point blank, can you tell us what you think the biggest mistake of your term has been up to this point? And what would you do? How would you do it differently? And the president was, as is so seldom seen among politicians, he was at a loss for words. Now, he might have been pretending to be at a loss for words, but I don't think he was. He was genuinely at a loss for words. And he said, look, I nothing comes to mind. I'm kind of on the spot here in the press conference and nothing comes to mind. I first heard that when I was listening to the press conference on the radio. And it was a little uncomfortable to listen to that, a bit of awkward silence there on the part of the president. A little uncomfortable, and you just hear it. Well, later that evening, I watched it on television. And what had been a slightly uncomfortable moment as I heard it on the radio, was an intensely uncomfortable moment as I saw it on television. Every time I listen or see one of these press conferences, and it really doesn't make any difference who's giving the press conference or what the subject is, I am always struck by the difference between hearing it and seeing it. For those of you out there who continue to persist in saying that the medium by which we get our information is neutral, my goodness, how can you continue to say that? The medium by which we get our message out is neutral. How can you continue to say that when, if you heard the press conference, there was a picture of a president, at least by what you could hear, full of confidence, brimming with confidence, and with a very confident message, to whether you agree with it or not. But if you watch the press conference, I was squirming. I was uncomfortable for the president because he looked uncomfortable. The medium is not neutral. Not in the least. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We call it Open Lines because it's anything you want to talk about. Your reaction to the president's press conference last week, to the story you may have read in Newsweek, The Gospel According to George. We just had an interview with Tamara Lipper, one of the co-authors of that story for Newsweek. And a couple other things I'd like to talk about in the course of the hour. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It was Marshall McLuhan who said the medium is the message. And maybe that's overstating the case, that the medium is the message. But the medium has an effect on the message. This is a debate that has not only been taking place in the culture. To what degree does the medium affect the message? If you have as your primary source of information the newspaper, you will get a very different impression of the events in the world than if you have as your primary source of information the radio. And again, a very different set of impressions on the events in the world if your primary source of information is television. Or for that matter, there's a fourth in here, the internet. Most of us consume our information from all different sources and through all different media. But any good producer of radio will tell you there are certain things that radio can do, and it can do it very well. And you do those things, you don't try and do the other stuff. It would be useless for me to, say, use charts and graphs, right? You can't see them. And there are certain things you simply can't describe. Numbers don't work very well on the radio because numbers don't translate well into when you're picturing that thing in your head. That's why we play sound on the radio, because sound is the medium exclusively of radio. Television is different, though. Television is not only what you hear, television is what you see. Think about that. The difference between hearing the president give a press conference and then seeing him give a press conference. Now, I'll tell you another story. It was the State of the Union address. I heard the president's State of the Union address that was delivered after, this was the 2002 State of the Union address, I think it was, January 2002, after September 11th. I heard it first on the radio. And I thought, you know, in terms of content, you know, just the raw data and the things he had to say, fine and good. But I wasn't particularly impressed with the president's delivery, to be honest with you. I was listening to it on the radio. I try and make a point of doing this. I later went back and I watched it on television. An entirely different impression. What had been in my mind up to that point kind of so-so good, but he could have done a better job of getting it across. I was thoroughly impressed with what I saw on television. You see, the visual element not only changed my impressions, it may well have changed the way the actual message of the thing. Well, the medium may not be the message, but the medium definitely affects the message. Was that your impression as well? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Seems like only months ago we were telling you about this Bible zine. That's a new term in publishing, Bible zine. Cross between a Bible and a magazine. Well, it is a Bible because it has the text of the Bible in it, but it's in the form of a magazine. In the case of what we talked about before, Revolve, it was a Bible zine for girls, for teenage girls. It was a 388-page magazine. It's actually the New Testament, but it's interspersed with pictures, quotations, little things of interest, box, by little sidebars, things like that. No advertisements, no advertisements, no overt advertisements. The cover doesn't look like a Bible. It looks like the cover of any teen magazine. And the little sidebars deal with subjects that are thought to be relevant to teenage girls. This thing sold well, sold very well. What did it retailed back in July of last year for about $15. It sold 30,000 copies in the first month, more than any other Bible for that period published by Thomas Nelson. And by the way, Bibles remain the mainstay of income for Christian publishing. 40% of their income every year, Christian publishers, come from Bibles alone. Which is probably why when you walk into a Christian bookstore, there's so many different kinds. I mean, if they were selling one kind, I'm not just talking about translations, I'm talking about kinds. There's student Bibles, mother's Bibles, father's Bibles, children's Bibles, and now Bible zines. Well, if 40% of your income comes from one product that you are not permitted to change the content of, I mean, you can't come out with new sequels to the Bible or prequels to the Bible like you can the Left Behind series. You got to find another way of marketing it and another way of capitalizing on that 40% of your income. Here's the latest. Last summer, it was Revolve for Girls, 30,000 copies in its first month. Went on to sell 40,000 more with 10,000 additional orders. They couldn't keep it on the shelf after the media hit, of course. Thousands of emails pouring in from youth ministers and parents and young men themselves asking, make one for us. Revolve is for girls. Make one for us. Well, here it is. From Thomas Nelson, the latest of the Bible zines. Not Revolve, but Refuel. It's the male version of Revolve. When we come back from this break, I'll tell you more about it. And I imagine it's going to sell very well, too. Oh, by the way, in the offing from the same publisher, a Bible zine for women set to release in June of this year. And am I surprised by this or not? As of now, no plans to publish a Bible zine for men. Maybe it's because they know men, real men, won't buy it. They like the old version of the Bible without the pictures. We'll be right back. More Open Lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.